Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Oh boy, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy. Welcome to the Completely Unnecessary Podcast for Wednesday. That was a habit. We haven't done a non-Tuesday in a while. Wednesday, May 27th, 2020, alongside Ian Ferguson. I am Pat Contry. Today on the show, we'll be talking about lots of topics. Pac-Man's 40th birthday passed a few days ago, 4 days ago. Empire Strikes Back turns 40. A G2A update. We have a Q&A. We have a Patreon poll. We have a lot in the intro. And our good old buddy Zack Snyder comes back potentially in a topic. Ian, you're in a little pain right now.
I'm not doing real good. Yesterday, I got neck x-rays and confirmed that I have degenerative disc disease in my neck and my C6 and C7 vertebrae are fucked up.
Where's the
C6 and 7? C6 and C7 are the two vertebrae responsible for the load bearing of your skull and head.
So like right under the neck, basically?
They're the base by vertebrae.
By that nub that comes out?
No idea.
It's about the nub or a little bit below the nub.
So they're important ones. I don't really want to talk about it too much. I'm just going to try to get through the podcast. The pain is fucking constant. It has been for almost 2 months. I got a steroid shot there and had like a good week, but that wore off. Next step is orthopedic doctor, physical therapy, and potentially surgery. So that's fun. There's that. Doing good. Moving on. Clubhouse Games.
We're skipping over some stuff. First, you know, we've talked about it in a few weeks. We got books, we got pins, we got a limited t-shirt. Go to ultimatenintendo.com. You can check out the wares there. And the Not For Resale documentary. I'm down to the last box of Blu-rays before I have to reorder. I think I'm down to like 48 Blu-rays left there. So get them while they're hot.
I saw them in the kitchen.
Saw what in the kitchen? Oh, the box.
Yeah,
that's all. Ian, you could have stole them. I wouldn't know. You could have stole them and put them up on your own Amazon listing, like people are doing with the Switch to circumvent Amazon going after price gouging. They're saying, oh, it's the Nintendo Switcheroo console instead of the Switch. You know, making their own listings, because on Amazon you can make listings anything you want as long as you have a UPC number, and those are basically free. They don't cost anything.
That's crazy.
Yeah, that's all it takes. I mean, well, the book, you need an ISPN usually, but for something like that, you know, you can do that. I finally put the put the two special edition, the NES and Super Nintendo special editions, and the PAL one are finally on Amazon. I'm not sure why I never did that before. I was lazy. So you can buy them there or on my website at ultimatenintendo.com with the shop there. But before we get to Clubhouse Games, the game of the year, I had a little bit of a Twilight Zone day last week on Tuesday. So to begin with, we had the podcast as normal, but before the podcast, I had a little trip to the men's room. Might have been bidet, maybe not. And I dropped my phone on, you know, I have the stone slabs floor sort of thing. And I guess it's a little uneven because I have a bumper, and it's still I dropped it on its face and it smashed. And I've had cell phones for 16 years, and it's only twice that I've messed up the face of my phone ever. Now it's like literally right before the podcast. I was annoyed because I was like, oh, I felt I was in a good mood. I'm going to have a good day. So I felt like it was a Twilight Zone episode, like the one where, you know, time stops
You know, something breaks in the clock and the time stops. It was something weird happened that Tuesday because we did the podcast, and I think that went somewhat well, right? The podcast last week?
Sure.
But then after that, things got a little out of control because I had a revelation after Ian left. I was like, oh, we missed Pac-Man's 40th birthday. And we technically didn't because Pac-Man's birthday was 5 days ago, which would have been after the podcast. It was 4 days ago. It was Friday the 22nd. So 3 days after the podcast. So in between. But I was like, how about I do an impromptu NES Pong video related to Pac-Man's 40th birthday? And I had an idea because otherwise I wouldn't have done an NES Pong video. I don't know how long because the next book is getting started. I have other projects potentially in the works. So I was like, okay. So I went and I looked for all my Pac-Man merchandise. And he ain't seen the box. There's a lot of garbage. I got pillows. I got things like that. And we're going to have a whole topic later about Pac-Man's 40th birthday. But in the midst of that, I lost my Amazon Fire controller. My Amazon Fire controller, you know, controls basically like the smart TV for Amazon Fire. It creates like a smart TV thing. But it also controls the volume. And I lost it. And there's no reason I would ever lose a control like that. And I searched around my place for 6 fucking hours last Tuesday, over a week ago. And I went out of my mind. I texted Vonnie and I was like, did you see it? Did you use the TV? She's like, no. And I didn't know what happened to it. I was like, this thing disappeared off the face of the earth. Like, there's just no reason for it to have left. It's gone. And I usually keep my remotes on the couch or on the table. But the good news was that, like, I ended up, like, searching everywhere and I cleaned out, you know, part of my garage and, like, reorganized because I was on a frenzy. So I was in a weird mood then. I just felt weird. I felt like I'd slipped into an alternate dimension. On top of that, I noticed something very, very weird and strange when I went into my garage. So my garage has, you know, like those like square rubberish sort of tiles you put down. You know, you buy like a pack of 9 of them from like Costco, whatever. And there's a particular square that's 2 away from my heavy bag. And I usually stand there when I'm using the heavy bag. And it usually, because they're not perfect on the size and shapes, that one usually has a little bit of an air bubble because it's like squeezed in. It didn't on that day. And it had the last time I'd walked in there. I'm like, I cannot explain that. It's perfectly flat. And it's never perfectly flat. There's always little lip or it's a little bubble. And so I was weirded out by that. But then the day got even weirder because I got a random knock on my door in the middle of editing the podcast. And I go to the door and it's 2, I want to say, middle-aged people. Well, I'm technically middle-aged now, but they were probably like early 50s. It was a man and a woman come up to my door. And at this point, I'm like freaked out for lots of different reasons. And the woman goes, you have to tell me the color of your house. And I'm like, what? Your paint color. We're in the neighborhood and we're looking for a new paint color. And I'm like, this is bizarre that this is happening with everything else going on. But it seemed like it wasn't real. It felt like a skit almost. And I can't explain why, but I just felt like I was on guard already. But I was like, okay, sure. Please don't kill me. This is like a serial killer way to get into my house. I didn't let it in my house. And they weren't wearing masks, but I stayed away from them. But I do have the paint outside in the little, you know, closet outside. So I got them the paint can. They opened it up. They got their sample. They said, oh, thank you so much for this. And they got on their way. So it was just a bizarre fucking day. And so then the next, I didn't find my Amazon Fire remote for 2 days. You know where it was, Ian? Bring it all full circle. It was under a bunch of Pac-Man shit that I put on my couch that I got out to do the NES Punk video. So, like, if it wasn't for my creative sort of a spark, I wouldn't have went into the frenzy and slipped into the Twilight Zone for a day and a half and lost my Amazon remote, which kicked off this whole thing. I think what kicked it off was smashing my cell phone, which I had to get repaired. That was good fucking $80 gone right there. And I know it only costs like $20 for a screen. I'm not fucking dealing with replacing my own screen. I'm not dealing with that garbage. Just someone came up. There was a mobile repair man. He was cool. He brought his own little table. He kept outside, had his mask, and did his work. He did it like in 7 minutes. There's an easy 60, $70 for you, sir. Because those you probably buy those screens from China for like $9. And no, he did a good job, and that was it. And I was on my way there. So that was my Twilight Zone day. It was fun. But what are you saying, Ian? Clubhouse Games 51?
Just looking at this list here. Clubhouse Games 51 has early reviews, and they're good.
Yes, they're glowing, some of them.
Hello,
in fact, the Nintendo Life one was like started with some little cheeky little, why is it this and that? But then, like, after he got through all his complaints at Nintendo Life, he's like, oh, no, this is a brilliant game. Yeah, I'm trying to use the jargon in the UK that they use because the gentleman's from the UK. But he said it's really fun. It's extremely polished. Why would you not expect something that Nintendo polishes to be polished? I mean, there's nothing they published that... Is there anything that's been not polished that they've published the past 10 years? Or can you think
to
of it?
Mario Tennis Aces needed some updates.
There are no real stinkers. And why would they be?
How it looked
these are
the
games that have been established over...
Really?
Yeah.
That's kind of surprising.
There's some weird things going on there.
And some glitches, or just it just wasn't smoothed out
as much?
Yeah,
like some glitches and just some weird graphical things that it was strange. It was not...
Who was the dev on that?
It's probably Camelot.
Okay. But no, he said it looks
brilliant.
Actually,
I don't know.
He said that he said the one weird thing about it that stuck with me was that you can't instantly say, like, play again when you're in the game. You have to go back out to the menu, then back in. But he only says it takes, like, 6 seconds. But he said that's the one weird little thing about it where you can't just immediately put play again. You have to say, like, go back and then come back in. But you can always do an update with that, I would think, for that. So, yeah, there's a lot of outlets that did reviews. And they said that the games did a good job of the little tutorials at the beginning. He did say, though, they were kind of, like, American-centric in terms of the humor. Like, there's some, like, little kitschy humor between the little... You pick a little toy character, a little board game little, like, a statue little piece to represent you. But, no, he said the tennis worked great. He said the darts worked really great. Yeah. He said the sound design, he said, was really good on it. And he was surprised. So, like, there wasn't, like... To him, it wasn't really, like, a clunker in the bunch. Obviously, you're not going to play some as much as the others. But, no. Game of the year, Ian. I'm calling it. Jeff Keighley is going to present it, Game of the Year. This is going to sell. The hype, there's been a weird hype building for this game since this was announced, what, a couple months ago? This is going to sell several million, I think. This is going to be, like, a killer, I think, for Nintendo this year. Like, this is going to be, hold them over during the certain pandemic. Obviously, Animal Crossing sold a ton, but this is going to do pretty well at $40, I think. So, did you see any of the videos or any of the reviews?
I watched the video that went over all the games that, you know, it looks nice. I'll buy it.
Yeah, we're gonna do our little chess game. We never played chess.
Hounds and Hares Chess and Revenge.
Have you played Hounds and Hares before?
No, I just like the name.
I mean, it looks simple.
Yes.
So I guess one person's a hare and one's the hound?
That would be my guess, yeah.
And you have to get to the other side? Okay.
No, you have to trap the hound. Or you have to trap the hare.
What if you're the hare, though? You have to get away? I guess.
I don't know. You have to run in perpetuity.
Well, we'll find out. We're going to see the rules.
It's just like life.
It's just what?
You just have to keep running until you die.
Are you running until you die, Ian? That's kind of a dour note.
NVIDIA! So, AI is doing some weird shit.
Allen Iverson?
Yeah. And NVIDIA's AI watched Pac-Man and created an AI version of the game using AI. So for Pac-Man's 40th anniversary, NVIDIA announced it recreated the iconic arcade game without the support of a game engine. GameGAN, a generative adversarial network, watched 50,000 instances of the game. So 50,000 episodes, 50,000 playthroughs. The graphics company produced a faithful but blurry clone with full functionality.
Let's underscore that the AI basically coded its own game.
Yes.
Without having like a ROM or having its own code, it looked at the game and said, oh, I can make this game now precisely how it looks.
I can watch
how it feels and how it plays.
50,000 times I can watch how this game works and make it.
With scoring, how the ghosts move, how Pac-Man moves, the maze, obviously.
I think it was a good choice, an interesting choice, because with it being one screen, it doesn't have to see a lot of instances of anything. Everything that's going to happen on the game happens here. It's just different states that it gets to see that screen in.
Sure. But the ghosts do react differently in keys, and the four ghosts do have a little bit of an AI to them. You know, Blinky chases after you, and And Clyde kind of stays off in his own fucking world or whatever, you know. So, and one runs away from you. Which one runs away from you? Inky? There's no one named Kinky, right? That'd be a different game. Anyway.
Yeah, don't know.
But no, it's interesting because we spoke about this, about the AI that beat the professional Texas Hold'em players. Was it last year we spoke about it? Or earlier this year when I said, well, this is interesting now because Texas Hold'em is a lot more complicated than programming something to learn chess. Chess is just learning all the different scenarios and looking ahead and iteratively, you know, figuring out, okay, 35 moves from now, this can happen. That's not what happens in Texas Hold'em. Texas Hold'em is hand by hand, but remembering, trying to remember the patterns of the players and every bets that came before. It's an entirely different game. And that's why I was so impressed by the AI beating professional poker players, because that's hard to do when you're a regular, like it's hard to say, I'm gonna go out and beat all these poker players. Like, you might be able to beat a few of them, but to beat a whole table, that's you can never predict doing that, because there's a lot of randomness involved as well, obviously. So so according to this, non-gaming applications, the rule environment learning capabilities of GameGAN could help future machine learning programs, can save time creating simulations instead of requiring developers to do so. Applications like learning the layout of a warehouse and training self-driving cars. We can eventually have an AI that can learn to mimic the rules of driving, the laws of physics, just by watching videos and seeing agents take actions in an environment, said Sanja Fidler, director of NVIDIA's Toronto Research Lab, in a statement. So, there you go. It's interesting. I think we're 5 to 10 years away from this stuff taking off. I mean, we're starting to see it now with, they have like those little robot, little Dalek-looking security droid things. You ever see those things?
Yeah.
That walk around and do mm-hmm. things. And obviously, we have semi-self-driving cars. You still have to pay attention because people are dying now because they're not paying attention because their self-driving car can screw up. But we're starting to get there with Tesla and other things. But this seems like this is a whole other level of AI here. And it's scary. It means the machines are coming, Ian. Giant Pac-Man machines that they're going to program.
I every once in a while, after if I ask Siri a bunch of questions, I will thank Siri. I will say, "Hey Siri," and I will thank her.
Just so Siri remembers you.
Just in case.
Kill this one last. Let it go to the salt mines.
Just in case.
It go to the silicon mines in 2040. You know, by then.
Because I'm sure someone somewhere out there is keeping track of how many times someone says thank you to Siri.
Right. Yeah, I'll skip that topic. I'm not in a bad mood right now because of a sleazy CEO. Formula E driver was caught cheating after he got a professional gamer to drive his car in a virtual racing contest. This is funny to me. Just because, like, you didn't think this would be found out. Daniel Abt, ABT, asked ace sim racer Lorenz Horzing to take the controls of his virtual vehicle in the Formula E Race at Home Challenge Series in support of UNICEF. This is reported by The Race, which I'm guessing is a racing news website. I don't think I'd ever quote The Race ever on here. The pair were rumbled by two other competitors who spotted that something wasn't quite right. Professional Formula E driver Stoffel Van Dorn, I love that name. Stoffel sounds like delicious. Voiced suspicions about Abt after a race on Saturday, which his car suddenly performed far better than it had in earlier outings in the charity contest. Really not happy here because that was not Daniel driving the car himself, Van Dorn said on his Twitch stream after the race. Really ridiculous. I'm questioning if it was really Daniel in the car. Okay. According to reports, event organizers were able to confirm Abt's rule-breaking shenanigans after inspecting IP addresses that revealed he couldn't have been driving the virtual car. In addition, a Zoom live stream comprising 20 of the drivers showed someone who shouldn't have been Abt in a sim rig, but who should have been Abt, but whose face was blocked by an object in the camera.
Oh my god.
You can't make this up. What, are you going to put a plush animal, like a little dice hanging over the wheel? Come on, man. It's just for a charity event. What are you doing? It's not for prize money. It's ridiculous.
I would like to apologize to Formula E, all of the fans, my team, and my fellow drivers for having called in outside help during the race on Saturday. That's an interesting way of saying for cheating. Sorry for cheating on Saturday. I called in outside help.
I didn't take it as seriously as I should have. I'm especially sorry about this because I know how much work has gone into this project as part of the Formula E organization. Well, I didn't know there was a Formula E organization here, so now I'm learning about it. So you actually did good PR here. Event organizers disqualified Hat from the contest and ordered him to donate 10,000 euros to a charitable project. For his involvement, Horzing was kicked out of the event's contest for sim racers. Why? I don't understand. Why would you consider this? Like, no one's going to expect you to be as good in a racing sim versus in real life. Like, why would you? You think you're going to get away with that? People wouldn't be like, wait a second. This guy's getting into, you know, he's doing, Daniel is doing way better than last week now. What's going on? you didn't hear about this with, you hear about the guy rage quitting in the NASCAR. The guy rage quit.
So it looks like this guy has been actually penalized within Formula E as well. Formula E is actually a real race. It's an actual race. It's electric Formula One cars.
Sure, okay, so, I get that. Oh, yes. So it's electric. Okay.
So this is a virtual. So this is essentially, it's like we were talking about with the NASCAR. It's the same thing.
No, I get that. Okay. I just never heard of virtual Formula E.
Gotcha.
Okay.
But yeah, it looks like he's been dropped from...
Dropped?
Audi. His Audi drops him for using a ringer during a virtual Formula E race.
Daniel, what are you doing, buddy? You're a professional race car driver. That's like, it's so hard to get to that point.
It's for fucking charity.
It's a charity event. You're not like, it just boggles my mind. That's my new term for the past few weeks. I don't understand how people think they can get away with this, or why would you risk it? You show up, you race, hey, crash your damn race car. You don't want to do it. Just crash it in a couple of laps. No one's going to care. Just do that. Rage quit at least. You wouldn't. It's horrible. The guy from the NASCAR driver, or I think it was NASCAR IndyCar, I forget. He lost sponsors from just rage quitting and not completing the event. It's like, holy shit, dude, it's a video game.
Yeah.
Like, what are you doing? Well, in that case, that wasn't a charity thing. That was part of whatever they decided to do. So now you're just being disrespectful to the whole organization and the other drivers. They're trying to keep interest. Now they're doing real races again. They started doing that this past weekend. Or past week, they started doing real races with empty stadiums. So they're trying to get back to normal. As an aside, the NHL decided we'd cut the season at 71 games, and then they're going to do a 2014 playoff. They said that's what we're doing. We're going to cut the season short, go straight to the playoffs with, I guess, play-in tournaments and games. The NBA is now targeting, I believe, late July as a solid comeback, and they're not sure about the format if they're going to finish the season. I think they had 15 games left to play, roughly 15 or 16 games in the season. My take would be to play like 5 warm-up regular season games and then do play-in games for like the, you know, 9th and 10th seeds to get to against 7th, 8th. And that's, I think, what some people were saying, because that'd be more exciting to do that. And then you go into maybe a shortened playoff, but that means next season's going to not start until probably November. But there won't be a big layoff. They're going to go from the NBA Finals to like a month later start the new season. They have to, or else, you know, you're not going to start the new seasons up anymore. Anyway, that's an aside. What a wacky story that was. That was nuts. We had some Samurai Showdown news, Ian, that came out, which was interesting.
Yes. Samurai Showdown, it has a collection coming out by Digital Eclipse. It's going to be in the same style as their Street Fighter collection, their SNK 40th Anniversary collection, in terms of it's going to have a huge digital museum full of documentation and stuff like that. But the exciting thing about this, besides the usual thoroughness of the project, is Samurai Showdown 5 Perfect is being released to the public for the first time. So Samurai Showdown 5 itself is kind of an interesting game.
Not sure I played 5 before.
It has a standard release. It has a special release, which fixes some issues. And it was the last... release for the Neo Geo
very last, really? Wow.
MVS system.
I'll look that up.
But there was one other version that was in development that had been playtested but had never been released, and that was Samurai Showdown 5 Special Final Edition, or Samurai Showdown 5 Perfect.
Perfect!
And Perfect looks to add new storyline elements and stuff like that, new story sequences. I'm not sure what else it's going to add, but it's a pretty big deal. What was truly supposed to be the last game released for the Neo Geo by SNK is actually going to get a release with online play and all that.
So what I read real quickly about Perfect was that Neo Geo wasn't aware of this being in development. They went and they put it out and play tested at one location. Neo Geo found out about it and pulled it within like a couple of hours. They went and pulled the fucking cabinet or pulled the board or whatever out of there. So the only evidence that this existed was, I guess, someone had taken a picture of it in the arcade.
Right.
And that was it. Like, oh, it existed like a myth. Like, it was out here. We have a picture of it, whenever that was, 2004, 2005, whatever that would have been about. And so it's one of those strange sort of tales, right? And now they find it. They said, yeah, we had it complete. They got asked about it. And they're like, yeah, we got it probably laying around. So we don't have the code, but we have the ROM. It's like, okay, well, that's good enough. You got the ROM? Okay. Let's do this shit. Because you know Samurai Shodown, you know, has that hardcore, you know, you want to call it like a cult fighting following. It's an excellent series. I wish I played more of it. I loved the, you know, I used to love playing it in the arcade when it was there.
My favorite fighting game. Well, one of my favorite fighting game series. The new one is really, really good, too.
The new one's good?
Oh, the new one's fantastic.
It's just because it's a different sort of fighting game. And I just like fighting games that have weapons in it. Take out time killers. You know, I love Soul Calibur, obviously, who doesn't? But it's just a different style of a fighting game.
Time Killers is fantastic.
It's fantastically bad, yes. It's one of those games where you had to play it, but then you're like, this is the peak of bad Street Fighter clone games of the 90s. It's just the peak. I mean, I know there was Warzone, but it was bad.
I play the Genesis version with my friend Lincoln from time to time.
Is it pretty accurate, the Genesis version? You need 5 buttons, though, because you need a fucking head button and the limb buttons.
Yeah, I mean, we use the 6 button pads to play.
But then you can't organize it like the 5, like in the arcade was, you know, the head in the middle.
Yeah.
but blocking was back. That's right. There wasn't a block button. Mm-mm. But it was set up like Street Fighter. You had like a 1 in the middle, 2s in the side.
Left, right, and headbutt. And then your special decap move is you just hit all 5 of them at the same time.
Was it 5 or 3?
It's 5.
But I can never pull off... You can do the swing. I can never pull off the finishing, cut off all their limbs at the same time as the head.
You literally hit all the buttons
and
at
it
once.
Did the wacky thing.
And it's just like... It basically... I mean, the way we play the Genesis version is you basically beat the shit out of someone until they go dizzy. And if they go dizzy and you hit all the buttons at the right time, you'll do the crazy...
I can never do that. I can cut the head off because you just swing it, but I can never cut the limbs off. That was the only reason to play
it. I might be thinking just the head. I know what we've done, all the limbs, too. But yeah, anyways.
I'm sure there's a way to do it, but in the arcade, that's what the only saving grace of that game was, if you can call it, was that. I kind of like the weird cartoony graphics of Time Killers. But we're going off topic. Anyway, so it's an interesting story because, you know, who knows if we would this obviously would have seen the light of day, but obviously someone dug into it and was like, all right, now let's go. Let's do it. Let's do it. So this is going to come out. When is this coming out? June 11th on Epic Games Store. Then it's coming to Steam next week. And then Switch and PS4 in July. Gets a little more time to get it onto there with everything. So that's cool.
Time Killers boards aren't nearly as expensive as I thought they'd be.
Is that a JAMA board?
Yeah, I can get a Time Killers board for $120.
Do you have the buttons for it?
I've got 6 buttons on my cabinet.
Uh-oh. Ian's going to go Time Killers. You might as well buy the side art, get the converted.
Yeah, just...
How's your arcade machine doing? I haven't played your arcade machine yet.
It's great. I've just been playing a lot of Mr. Driller.
I'm just waiting to get my Rolling Thunder cabinet at some point. They come up for sale. They're like usually like $500, $600, $700. But being that they're dedicated, technically, there's not a huge amount of them out there. But they're nice little cabinets there. They had those cone player 1 and player 2 buttons. You know, the black cone buttons with the little mini button. Uh-huh. What are they called? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
They're like the elegant buttons for 1 or 2 players.
Yeah.
Like little red buttons on the top. Like they're like tiny, like thumbnail size buttons there. And then, you know, we can't stay a year away from them. Zack Snyder's Justice League cut was announced to come to HBO Max in 2021. Not Ian's Max, HBO Max. HBO Max is the new streaming service that's going to compete with Netflix and Hulu, and they got some heavy hitters lined up, and they're also funding Sesame Street going forward. So good for them to do that. And this is going to cost reportedly $30 million. So this cut was completed. And that was where this whole hullabaloo started back in the fall. Like, Zack Snyder went on his Instagram or some and showed the film canisters saying, like, this is my cut of Justice League. Like, the film cut. Like, he had it done. But obviously, they got to clean up some CG. They have to get actors back to do some dubbing, which is usually like the last part of the process.
Sure.
There, but it's gonna see the light of day next year, and there will be some people that sign up for HBO Max just to get this. This is a coup for HBO Max because this is tons of free marketing built into this. You know, you can't. I mean, $30 million to them is nothing to get this, and yeah, it's interesting because it's not like Justice League came out a long time ago. It came out 3 years ago. Like, that's it. That was like the peak of the DCEU, and after that, it all collapsed because that underperformed after Batman v Superman underperformed, and then it's been shaky ever since. Wonder Woman did great before that came out, and then Aquaman did well, but really didn't have real connections to Justice League, and then Shazam didn't have a connection to Justice League, and that did well. And then Birds of Prey performed horribly recently. That obviously we know all about Suicide Squad. It did so well that they're basically rebooting it, Suicide Squad, right, within 3-4 years. So, and then Flash is not coming out until 2022, which would be 5 years after Justice League. And then they canceled, any future Superman movies. And it is they're rebooting Batman. So the DCU is obviously a fucking mess. And it's not like me and Ian, we told you so a thousand times about this, but what's interesting about this is that this became mythical status, this film, in only 3 years, where it took other films like the Superman 2 cut, Richard Donner cut, because remember, Superman 1 and 2 were shot simultaneously by Richard Donner, then they shit-canned Richard Donner because they're idiots, the producers of Superman, and had like half of Superman 2 reshot, and had everything thrown out. So that release didn't come back out for like 25 years it took for Superman 2, the Richard Donner cut, to be released on DVD and to come out. This has only been 3 years, but people were clamoring for this, rightly or wrongly, saying we want to see Zack Snyder's original version of this, because Joss Whedon reshot a chunk of the movie, and they digitally recaptured the actors in scenes. They lightened up scenes that were originally dark. They cut out subplots. You know, they cut out Lex Luthor. They cut out. Was it Darkseid was originally in it? They basically remade the movie. It's an entirely different movie, just like the Donner cut of Superman 2 is basically a different movie.
Sure.
That has some relationship to the original, but here you go. So, do you have any thoughts on this? I mean, it's interesting. I kind of want to see it, just because the Justice League that came out, I saw it on the plane. It's not even bad. It's just so bland, the Justice League movie, and you can see why no one really liked it, because it didn't really have its own identity by itself. I get that.
Yeah, I mean, I have no interest in it. I still haven't seen the original, and I highly doubt it's magically going to be the movie he gets right. But,
well, here's the thing, Ian. It's reportedly 4 hours long.
Jesus Christ.
So this isn't on Zack Snyder again. This is on Warner Brothers for giving Zack Snyder keys to the kingdom, which obviously failed.
And I mean, it's on Zack Snyder, too.
It is, but it's like giving a 5-year-old a shotgun. Okay, it's like, here you go, have fun.
That's fine.
Who's, you know, I mean, I'm sure Mr. Snyder's a nice guy, but he's a 5-year-old making movies, basically, when it comes to this stuff.
He's a fucking edgelord.
Yes. He's an edgelord. Yes. We'll say that.
My Batman movie would go there.
He'd be raped in prison. What? No. We don't need that.
You talk dark. My movie would go there.
We're not talking. We don't need gaming rapists in our world anyway.
Fucking ridiculous.
Another edgelord right there, who coined that, sleazy CEO. Anyway, so let's not pretend, Snyder fans out there, that had this come out, this would have saved the DCU, because no, it was already done. It was fucking done at that point.
That's what I'm getting at. This isn't going to magically be the movie he fucking nailed. This isn't going to be the movie he got right. Fucking Batman v Superman, bad. Man of Steel, bad. This wasn't going to magically be
good.
Well,
they've gotten progressively worse. Because you can say he got all this job because of Watchmen and then Man of Steel. But Watchmen was Watchmen is considered largely widely considered the greatest graphic novel of all time. You would think the movie based on that would at least be in the top 15 of superhero movies. It isn't even in the top my top 20. It's not even in my top 20. It doesn't even get to there. Like it doesn't even cross into there. X-Men 2 is in there before there. The original Superman is in probably my top 5. People forget how great the original Superman was. You know, like he to me he overdirects on style and underdirects on substance. And that's not controversial. That's all of his movies. Yes, sure. 300 is nice to watch, but there's no substance to that movie at all. You know, I'm not going to bring up Dawn of the Dead. That's a nice little watch. I saw that in theaters. There's no substance to that movie compared to the original Dawn of the Dead. Sure. It's just, oh, it's flashy, zombie movie. It's artistically, it looks artistic. I don't know about the one that you hate. The one with all the anime women one. I don't know if you like...
Oh, Sucker Punch?
Yeah, Sucker Punch. Like, I have no idea if that's even decent. But the point is that when you're doing a cinematic universe, you have to have substance laid down. The bearers of substance and not just style. Or people like me are like, I don't want to watch this. I mean, I try to sit through Batman v Superman, and I've seen like chunks of it here and there whenever it's on TV. It's a chore to watch that movie. It's a chore,
sure,
to sit through it. You don't watch it and say this is a comic book movie, you know, or even graphic novel movie. So when you give that person the keys to a multi-billion-dollar kingdom, and it falls flat in your face, don't think that the 4-hour supercut would have saved it, because it's not like they would have released a 4-hour cut anyway. They wouldn't have released a 3-hour cut in theaters.
No,
even.
It would have been 2 hours and 25 minutes,
or 2.5.
So it would have been a cut anyways. This is just a fucking masturbatory dream project.
Who approved the budget to go and shoot a 4-hour movie? Because Endgame was 3 hours, and that was long in the tooth, but that was like the most I could have sat through. You know, Avengers was like 3 hours. I mean, it used its time well enough, but it's like, come on, man. What are we doing now here? Let's get this over with. Pat's got to take a piss. He got a giant-sized soda here. But am I interested in watching this, though? Yes, because there's like supposedly Green Lanterns show up in this. For parts of the movie, or Martian Manhunter is in this supposedly, and Darkseid's in it, and Luthor's in it because he was in Batman v Superman. So it would be nice to see an original director's vision completed, because it is a shame when that gets pulled away from them. Supposedly there's a director's cut of the original Suicide Squad with David Ayers that was pulled away. That won't be any better, because Suicide Squad was awful with what they had anyway. So yeah, you can maybe sort of smooth out the original director's vision. It would not have set the world on fire, the Zack Snyder cut.
Sure.
Batman v Superman did awful with critics. It underperformed. We know that. That's why this universe was taken away from him. A Zack Snyder universe Wonder Woman would have been awful to watch. Or Aquaman.
Oh, God.
Those movies were a little more upbeat.
A Zack Snyder Wonder Woman would have been brutal.
Would have been terrible.
Yeah.
Or Flash. Like, Flash is like an upbeat, zany character. It would have been terrible to watch. So it's coming to HBO Max. There you go. Not Ian's Max again. So anyway. Well, that's it for our 37-minute long intro there. And I didn't think we'd get that long. You ready to go for the main podcast topics? If you're watching on YouTube, remember, this is an audio podcast as well. Go on Podbean, Google Play, Stitcher, iTunes. Search for Completely Unnecessary Podcast, or go to cupodcast.podbean.com and listen to the rest of it while Ian fingers his... finger handheld was it Ms. Pac-Man or Pac-Man game?
It's a Pac-Man 40th anniversary Tamagotchi, which is why I'm holding it, because that's our next topic.
40th birthday for Pac-Man! Woo!
Happy birthday, guy.
May 22nd, 1980. Also a Taurus like me, Pac-Man. Tauruses are nice.
I thought you said tourist.
Well, he was a Taurus at first. Puck-Man comes out originally. By Namco. Turo Iwatani developed it at Namco. They put it in a few locations on May 22nd, and then later they widely released it in Japan later, and it came to the U.S. near the end of the year, I believe, some early December, mid-December, something like that. I don't know the specific time, but somewhere near the end of the year. So it's a 1980 video game here. So Pac-Man is an interesting game, because you can almost look at Pac-Man and see, like, this is the official launching point into the mainstream and pop culture of video games, and it started with Pac-Man, by and large. You can almost divide up video games how they were looked at almost on a creative level pre and post Pac-Man to me. Before Pac-Man, if you look at, there was obviously Space Invaders, there were some arcade games. To me, they were more, we'll just say, abstract in sort of creation. It's like, oh, you're a spaceship guy, you're just shooting stuff. Or you're like the Midway game. Oh, you're doing an Old West shootout. You're shooting each other.
Sure.
Or the game I thought of, the vector graphics game that I couldn't think of last week. Warrior was like the one-on-one lightsaber. Oh, 79.
Warrior. Yeah. I don't think of that as lightsaber, but yeah,
it's a lightsaber. It kind of looks like a lightsaber. But the whole point is that
there's a pit you can fall into.
Yes, I've only played it once in my life. But these are like more like abstract. What you can do in real life as a video game. You can sword fight. You can shoot out the OS. You can do shark hunting. I'll bring up a list of games from, like, say, 75 to 79. But you see my point. You are not taking on, like, a mascot character and then sort of world-building to that extent around this cartoonish character.
Sure.
That has a personality. This is now thinking about, to me, video games in a brand new way. In Space Invaders, you're a nameless nobody in a ship. In Missile Command, which what year was Missile Command? Was that 80 or 81? You don't have an identity. You're just commanding the ICBM knockout. Missile Command was 80, so around the same time. When you're playing Centipede, you're either a gnome in some version or you're like a spaceship. Like
sure.
You don't have the personality. So
5200 version, you're a little elf with a wand.
Is that what you're, elf? That's some of the graphics, right? You're an elf, not a gnome. You see what I mean, though?
Yeah.
So, do you have any Pac-Man memories you want to talk about?
I actually wrote about them last week, but Pac-Man always reminds me of my grandparents on my mom's side. Growing up, there was a 5200 in their living room. So I probably played this for my first time, probably like 84, 85. I was born in 82. But I remember sitting on my grandfather's lap and him teaching me how to play Pac-Man. And the weird thing about this 5200 is it would have been my youngest uncle, who I think was just finishing high school probably at that time. But I never saw anyone in my family use that 5200 except for my grandfather and my grandmother. And like every once in a while my mom would play kicks or something on it during the holidays over there. So my grandfather taught me how to play Pac-Man, and it was the only game that either of them, I think, ever really, you know, got attached to. They had an Apple IIe for a long time, and my grandma got really into Lode Runner. But yeah, Pac-Man was like the beginning and the end of video games for some people, and I think that's a good example. It was
like the peak to them.
Well, it was, you know, it was one of those things where they weren't ingrained in everyday life, and you could be old enough where something popular would come out and be like, oh, I played Pac-Man. It's like when we talk to people like Frank or whatever, they remember playing Atari or something like that, but they don't always... They did it when it was popular. They did it when it was cool. But
it was still a fad.
It was still a fad.
It was considered a fad.
But, no, even into, like, you know... the mid-90s, I remember my grandfather would fire up that 5200 every once in a while and play Pac-Man, to the point where I would look for controllers for him when I'd go to flea markets, because the 5200 controller was notoriously fucking awful. My mom actually got good at taking them apart and cleaning them and putting them back together to keep them in working order for him. And then, like I said, I talked about it in my writing this week, but I remember... a memory that I have that's very fond of my grandmother is my grandfather was in the hospital for what must have been, I don't know, must have been like his baker's dozen heart attack. He had so many heart attacks. And he was in Cleveland Clinic for a couple of weeks. And I was staying with my grandmother watching the house so she could go, you know, travel, be with him, do all sorts of things. So I was taking care of the mail, answering phone calls, that sort of thing. And they had Pac-Man on their gateway computer. It came in one of those Microsoft Arcade packages. I don't know which one. So I took to playing it. And my grandmother played it as well. And long story short, this one kept track of scores, and I had set some score. It was good at the time. It wasn't like competitive good, but it was good. And like 2 months later, my mom got a random call from my grandmother, and all it was my grandmother telling my mom to tell that punk grandkid of mine I beat his high score, and she hung up.
Oh, wow.
So apparently for 2 months she was very, very intent on beating my high score.
Good for her.
And she did. So yeah, no, I love Pac-Man. I have lots of Pac-Man tchotchke. I love playing the different games. I'm a huge Namco fan. Most people know that. Pac is kind of the Namco mascot. So I have a lot of love for Pac-Man and the games. But yeah, no, I absolutely immediately think of family when it comes to Pac-Man.
Pac-Man, look, I had this book, Pac-Man. I've had this book forever. This came out in 82. And it's by the editor, it's a consumer guide. And if you want to talk about how many games in the history of video games you could have produced a book like this that not just covers like strategies, it covers all the merchandise, it covers promo items, it talks about,
and that's from when, 82,
so we're talking the height.
There's a lot of shit out for it by that point.
But you have in here a culture, like events out in the public that were themed around Pac-Man. This talks about the lawsuit with Casey Munchkin between Philips and Midway and Atari sued them. Actually, Casey Munchkin's covered in this book, surprisingly. They go through the game and say, oh, it's a decent game. It's kind of surprising, but it's Consumer Reports. Talks about Pac-Man Day happening at malls and events out there and people dressing up in these... I hope that costume still exists, that giant furry Pac-Man
it's
costume.
Terrifying.
It's great. So you're really talking about, this is the first time you could do this with a video game.
Sure.
And there's not many games after this you would have the popularity to have done this with. You probably can talk about maybe three or four games ever, or that reach, I'd say, the cultural significance. Mario did. But the thing about Mario was, it wasn't a single game that got him there. It had to be multiple games that got Mario there to get ingrained to that extent. With Pac-Man, it was just the one game you needed. And yeah, there were sequels and Miss Pac-Man definitely helped, but just the one game was enough to sort of shoot him off into the stratosphere.
Sure.
And then it peaked with Ms. Pac-Man, and after that it was a slow, you know, down. You peaked with Ms. Pac-Man, because after that, you know, Junior Pac-Man, Super Pac-Man, Pac-Man Plus, you kind of run out of steam there with the iterations of a maze game, right?
Mm-hmm.
Until you get to, like, you know, Pac-Land, and you have a different game that some people love, like me, but...
I think Pac-Land is great.
But it's not really a popular game. But...
The turbo version is so good.
Is that it's based on the Japanese one? Because you have the long nose. We talked about that in the video game years.
Yeah.
but you see what I mean, though. How many games could you have done a book like this and talked about cultural events in the mainstream, political cartoons where they used them? Sonic, maybe. Mario, Pac-Man.
Yeah.
That's basically it.
I would say Sonic, Mario, Pac-Man are kind of it.
I don't know if Sonic ever reached the heights of Pac-Man in terms of being everywhere and people talking about it in the news, like news, like, yeah, like, you know, news. Then again, arcades were such on a heavy rise that they were covering arcades like a new phenomenon, because they kind of were,
sure,
to that point. But going back to the games that, the sort of like, what were video games like? This is a list on Clob, which is now arcademuseum.com. I missed the original Clob name. These are the sort of games that that came out, like, on, you talk about 79, you're talking about, I don't know if they're still making Fairchild games in 79, but you had, and then television wasn't really out yet until 80, mainstream. So we're talking about Atari 2600, and then, what, Odyssey 2 in 79? And that's really it? Really?
Yeah.
Because I don't think RCA Studio 2 was really selling. But you had games like Triple Attack, Meteorites, Hyperspace, Meteoroid, Galaxian, you had Lunar Lander, Splash, Fortress, Field Goal, Dodge'em, Atari Baseball. Like, cosmic monsters. So you had alien games, sports games, army games, or military games, and that's really it. Like, that was like your game breadth.
Right.
It was for, like, adults, or geared towards largely a male audience, and that was it. Like, it had not figured out the sweet spot of let's get a game that everyone could enjoy. Boys and girls, men and women. It's cute. It's colorful. Like, it didn't phase them that that was an idea yet. It's just amazing. Like, that wasn't a thing yet. Then, obviously, afterwards, we'll throw everything at the wall. We'll get Donkey Kong. We'll license Pop. Nintendo will license Popeye. You know, like Nintendo wasn't doing games like this yet.
No. I'm trying to think what they would have been doing at that point.
Let's see. Any Nintendo games came out in 79 here? Then a game called SF High Splitter. What is that game?
I have no idea.
Can't even find it. I'm guessing that would have been like a game like, I don't know, maybe like Radar Scope. They did a game called Space Launcher, Head On N, Monkey Magic, Radar Scope, obviously, Sheriff, Battle Shark.
Okay, Sheriff. I was thinking Sheriff would have been that era. So, but that's another like Wild West shoot him. Yeah,
like the Midway game. Block Fiber. What is that, like a cereal thing? Computer Othello, Shooting Trainer, and then Wild Gunman Shooting Trainer, which was not the Nintendo Wild Gunman we know of. That's just that was probably the light gun one, I'm guessing. Yeah. You know, with live actors there.
Right.
I thought that was earlier than 79, but Klob is off on some dates because they have Puckman listed on 79 and it's not 79. Obviously, it's 80. So, yeah. So, that's what I mean when I talk about the history of video games you could divide with Pac-Man.
Yes. You can't. There's a very obvious before and after.
That's what I mean. And that's why most important video game, bar none. Sorry, Norm, I have to rub that in. Anyway, so this is why I think it's important. And obviously, we all love Pac-Man. I love the resurgence of Pac-Man in the past, say, 10, 12 years with Pac-Man Championship Series and Battle Royale arcade game.
Like, man, Pac-Man Championship Edition, the first one, was the reason I bought my 360. And for the first,
was it really?
For the first month I had my system, it was the only game I had on there was Pac-Man Championship Edition. I literally bought a 360 for that game.
Just to play good old Pac.
Just to play Championship Edition.
And obviously, any barcade you go in, if you can go back into them, has a Battle Royale machine.
Oh, Battle Royale is so good.
It's so good. It's quick. You play the game in a few minutes with four people. You know, the cocktail version or the awesome giant deluxe monstrosity one, which I don't know what that even would cost to buy that. 10 grand.
The one with the bar stools and all that shit?
Yeah, the one that worth.
It's got the four bar stools and the big TV.
And each player has his own console
to
play with. God, it's fantastic. There.
I also want to mention real quick the popularity of Pac-Man. I mean, he's popular in Japan, but he is hugely popular in the U.S., more so than I think people think. I think people think his popularity is universal, but there are certainly times where I think Pac-Man is probably more popular than in Japan. For instance, these Pac-Man Tamagotchis are U.S. only. They're not even being released in Japan.
Those are somewhat new?
Yeah, they just came out for the 40th anniversary.
So you don't think a lot of those crappy all-in-one joysticks at GameStop came out in Japan, just came out here.
Like, they might have, but I mean, Pac-Man is important, but he's not, like, his popularity in the U.S., you know, it's not just an extension of Japanese popularity. In a lot of ways, he's more popular here, I would say, than he even is in Japan.
I guess that makes sense.
There are products that straight up, like I said,
they don't come out.
I mean, Tamagotchi, that's Bandai, that's a Japanese company. They make all sorts of special edition ones. They do Pokemon ones. They do Evangelion ones. They do Pac-Man ones, and you think that they would be available over there? They decide they don't care.
We have the cartoon here. I maybe never got translated into Japanese, and obviously we had the hit Buckner and Garcia number one song there. Yeah, well, there was no video game cartoons before Pac-Man, or there was no you weren't doing hit songs before that. And obviously the amount of toys and plush and PJs, and again, it's all in this book, and I'll talk about this in the NES Punk video that I shot that I have to edit this week there, that it was a phenomenon. And it was such a phenomenon that the utter disappointment over the shitty 2600 version was one of the sparks that lit the video game crash fuse.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking the most popular game, one of the most popular games of all time, we'll just put out a horrible version of.
Absolutely miserable.
Miserable. And I can't believe they let that go out. I mean, obviously they wanted to probably make dates, but like, I can't believe they wouldn't think that would be a bad idea. And then they overproduced them by several million. Like,
they made more copies than there were Ataris sold at that point.
Like, why would you?
I mean, as we've learned about...
They're the anti-Nintendo.
As we've learned... Well, I was going to say, you can learn a lot from Nintendo these days. I mean, even your most popular games don't have a one-to-one attach rate.
Because that's insane. Why would you do that?
That would be insane. And then to make enough copies so that everyone who owns an Atari can have one, plus sell more systems, so you make them for more than a one-to-one attach rate.
Instead of seeing how something will sell, even do maybe half attach rate. A half attach rate never even happens. Ever. Well, but let's make sure we do that and then make more afterwards. Like, get that money now, Warner Communications. Get that money right now and then put us out of business. And then it was a pack-in on the 5200. You think they would have realized, okay, we're going to make up for an error because it's a lot closer to the arcade, even though it's not an arcade translation because it's wider.
I love the 5200 version. I love the way it looks.
You think they would have figured out that we would not have crappy analog joysticks, or at least provide a digital joystick to play the most popular arcade game. They didn't even provide an option, Atari, for that. They didn't even say, well, we know this is a shitty packing controller. Here's your $20 Pac-Man controller.
Right.
They didn't even do that. They let third parties try to do that. And that's why the third party 5200 controllers like the Wiko's go for like $80.
Well, the Wiko is kind of like an attachment thing. It's basically...
You have to attach it to it, yes.
You use a standard... You can use the Wiko controller, yes. Or you can get a Wiko adapter that will let you use an Atari 2600 controller as well.
You have to interface with a shitty digital readout of the buttons that almost no game fucking used. You know, you had to do that.
Yeah.
But see what I mean, though?
So we've had them at work before.
I have a few of the Wiko ones I found that... At the swap meet for like $15. I saw those with like games. Like, okay, I'm grabbing these. I know they're hard to find. But you think Atari would have learned their Atari is just like the model of never learning their lesson, like for like 15 years.
Yep.
That's basically what happens. Anyway, so happy birthday, Pac-Man. Being 40 isn't bad. Get a few gray hairs, but you know, do some yoga. You know, eat a little healthier. We'll keep going. We'll keep it going strong. Ian, I got my first cell phone with one of those big wireless providers years and years back. I've honestly hated my monthly bill ever since, but then I discovered there's another option that could give me premium service I'm used to at a fraction of the cost. I could cut my wireless bill down to just $15 a month and save hundreds of dollars a year by switching to Mint Mobile. For anyone out there who's looking to save without sacrificing service, switching to Mint Mobile is a no-brainer. By going online only and eliminating the traditional cost of retail, Mint Mobile can pass those savings on to you. Every plan comes with unlimited nationwide talk and text, plus crazy fast 4G LTE. You use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and keep your same phone number along with all your existing contacts. They just mail you the SIM card in the mail. You get the app, you sign up, and there you go. And if you're not 100% satisfied, Mint Mobile has you covered with their 7-day money-back guarantee. To get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month and get your plan shipped to your door for free, go to mintmobile.com/CU podcast. That's mintmobile.com/CU podcast. Cut your wireless bill to just $15 a month at mintmobile.com/CU podcast. Ian, our favorite gray market digital game seller, G2A, is back in the news.
Yeah, so G2A is back in the news for putting their foot in their mouth. So G2A made a promise after they got called out.
What's G2A real quick?
So G2A resells keys for games. A lot of people will go there initially because they're looking for a price on a game. Steam might have a game for $60. Epic Game Store might have a game for $60, and you're looking around and you might see this website called G2A that might have that game for $25, $15, $30.
Under $50?
Yeah.
$50.
Huh? Oh, yeah.
Isn't that nice?
So you what G2A is, though, is it's essentially it's oftentimes used as a fence for stolen codes, is what G2A is. So G2A ideally it's a place where you buy a code for a game for cheaper. How would people acquire these legitimately? Their thinking is like, okay, so if you're a reviewer and you've got a billion review codes or something and you're never going to use them all, you sell the review codes on G2A or something.
Or a Humble Bundle, you get individual codes?
Humble Bundle, I think. Yeah, you can get the codes too. So that's another way you could sell it if you already have the game.
But otherwise, getting them legitimately to sell them, or I guess if you bought it and then never used it and you want to sell it.
Also, I just need to say that it's kind of gross to sell a code that you're given for free.
Oh, it's disgusting to do that.
Yeah, it's disgusting. Because, but those are the legitimate ways you would be able to, you know, get these codes.
But G2A is known also for being a site where fraudulent chargebacks. And you get the codes real quick because then you basically then have a credit that you can sell. So that's been known to happen when credit card numbers get wiped out of a database somewhere.
Yeah. So what happens is basically to make money, people will take like a stolen credit card and they'll buy a shitload of codes for a game. Once those codes are turned into something, you don't know if that code is valid or not until you try to input it. So what'll happen is they'll buy all these codes, they'll get these codes, they'll put them up for sale on G2A. The codes stay even after there's a chargeback.
Sure, you have the codes in your text pad folder.
Right. So then the codes are still sold, and then it's a dead code. So there's been lots of negativity about G2A for good reasons. A lot of developers, most developers I know, and some of them have said it publicly, if you can't afford our game,
pirate it.
Just pirate it, please. Like, don't buy it from G2A because you're supporting what is oftentimes criminal activity, but you're giving money to people for something that they got for nothing.
And it's allegedly used by money launderers as well.
Yes.
To wash their money by buying coats for games.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Allegedly. So, last year they said that they were offering to pay studios 10 times the cost of their games if it was found to be selling stolen keys. Only one company took them up on the offer. Turns out that G2A was selling a bunch of stolen keys.
I don't know why everyone wouldn't do that. It's okay.
Maybe just not worth their time, but it doesn't bode well for them when they come out and they say with bravado, 10 times if we're selling stolen keys. Only one developer, took them up off on it. And out of their one out of one shot, they were selling stolen keys. So in a blog post called Keeping Our Promise, G2A says that of the 321 keys Woob reported as having been stolen, their internal investigation revealed that 198 had been sold by G2A.
There you go.
As a result of that, G2A is now paying the company $39,600, or 10 times the value of any bank-initiated refund costs that Factorio paid in relation to each of the 198 illegitimate keys sold via Marketplace. So
you think that this doesn't mean that G2A are good guys by doing this. It just shows that
No, it doesn't mean they're good guys at all. It shows that they are doing exactly what people have been saying they're doing, that they claimed.
And this is a smaller game. Imagine the larger companies, how much fraud's going on.
Right. Exactly.
Like, this doesn't exonerate them. This proves it.
Yeah, exactly. This is not exoneration. Just because you're like, okay, good, you said what you did, but yeah, you were trying to say that this does not occur. It obviously does. Clearly, it occurs.
We've got to read their statement with crocodile tears here. When we launched this offer, we wanted to send a clear message to the gaming community that fraud hurts all parties. As we spell out in this blog, fraud directly hurts individuals who buy illegitimate keys. It hurts gaming developers and ultimately hurts G2A because we are forced, as a transaction facilitator, to cover costs related to the sale. We wanted to amplify that message and capture people's attention, so pledged to compensate developers 10 times the value of any chargeback fees they incurred, despite the fact that we had nothing to do with the illegal acquisition of these keys. Well, you provide the marketplace for the illegal activity to occur.
Exactly. You have provided...
You're providing the playpen for the illegality. The gaming developer community has our solidarity and sympathies on this issue, and want to continue building bridges. With our main point being made about the seriousness of fraud in the industry, from now on, we will compensate developers the full value of any chargeback fees they incurred for any keys sold via G2A Marketplace if they are able to prove they were illegitimate.
I think it's important to point out now that now they will only pay back the chargeback fees.
Yes.
They're not doing a 10-time thing. Now that they've realized that maybe...
Oh, they know.
They know. But
they didn't know anyone would go through this, and then I'm surprised they actually went through with their own internal investigation and came up with it. They could have said, "Oh no, there's nothing. It's fine."
Right.
So they. But imagine if like Ubisoft went to them and said, "Okay, we want a full auditing."
Yep.
And it was like several thousand keys. Just imagine that. You know, that's why I would, it would unfortunately spotlight them and let people know they exist. But like you would hope that these companies would go after them, you know. But maybe other companies have a better way of knowing when these chargebacks happen because of the credit card theft and things like that. And I don't know. No, you're not endearing yourself to the game developers and publishers.
No.
They look at you as what you are. You're thieves.
And Luke Plunkett, who wrote this article for Kotaku, says it great in his closing. Apparently fraud hurts G2A because we are forced as the transaction facilitator to cover costs related to the sale. Who wrote this? Why is the onus here on helping them discover their own fuck-ups instead of G2A pledging to do a better job sourcing keys? How about because you find a way to stop selling stolen keys?
Because I can't source keys anyway.
Right. Their business, and that's the thing. And I wanted to say this when you mentioned it being a playground. There are places, for instance, Twitter exists, AOL, for you know when it existed, chat rooms, all these things, all these places that you know, all these like large. You know, social networks, illegal things can happen on them. But that's not the entirety for its existence. There is no way to source discount keys other than doing it this way. Your entire company exists for this purpose because there is no ethical way to source keys. You can't go out and get these. You have no other way to get these. There's the two ways that you're going to get them. The one way that is halfway okay, that's fine, selling off your excess fucking Humble Bundle keys if you've already got the game.
Sure.
Fine. I mean, most people I know are fucking decent humans and just give them away because you already got them.
But that's not, that wouldn't be illegal, though.
But that wouldn't be illegal.
Yeah.
But it's fucking absolutely dirty to sell off review codes that you're given and be on the pall to fucking act like, you know, there's not...
But there's not enough review codes in existence to support a set
that's
like
G2A. Yeah, no, exactly. And that's what I'm getting at. The only way to truly have enough codes is through these... gray or black market means.
Yeah, even calling this gray market is weird because I would love to, if you did a full auditing of the percentages and see what it came up with. Would it be half and half, half fraudulent or half were acquired fraudulently with chargebacks and stolen credit card numbers and half weren't? I would love to see the percentages.
If there's a way a company like this can exist ethically, I'd love to know it because I cannot think of any.
Well, Humble goes out and they partner directly.
That's what I mean. But that right then and there makes Humble something different. There is no way to just be a third-party fence for codes. You can't do it.
And Humble curates and they...
Subscription. So Humble's really taken off to kind of be its own thing. And yes, of course, obviously they're going out there and working with actual developers to get things into bundles to be cheaper.
Yes. It's a win-win.
Right.
It's a ton of exposure. You get your name out there. They have their own store now, you know, where it basically operates on its own. And now they do, like you said, they do their subscription thing where they offer, you know, free games for the monthly fee. Every month you get whatever, a handful of free games.
And honestly, if I played more games, it looks like it's a fairly good deal. The stuff that they put in those monthly, like, subscription bundles and look decent. They're good games.
And they support devs. They now are funding devs to help finish games.
And they also, there's also always a way to donate to charity. Humble Bundle's always done that. Humble Bundle is great. That's, I mean, if you want something, that's your best option.
But no, you're not going to find a GTA 5 there for $8.
And you can't just go and search for something and have it pop up. Like it's curated. It's based on what they can offer you.
Would there be a way to do this legally? Like if I went to EA or Ubisoft and said, I want 50,000 keys at this discount wholesale, the same way you can wholesale, you know, physical video games. But as you know, there's a built-in cost. Obviously, it would cost them less to get me the keys. It's literally generating and giving me. Would a company be down for that? I wonder if they would. But to me, they probably wouldn't because they'd be like, well...
There's no stock to move. There's nothing to produce. I don't think that they see it as something that they need to get rid of because they're going to move those games anyways. So
there's enough existing stores.
Right. There's enough existing stores and people are going to... It's been shown. When you're not... Nintendo does it all the time. When your stuff doesn't go on sale all the time... People just buy it for regular price.
They're trained. Or rarely goes on sale. Nintendo does sales, but it's like the game's never new or even a year old. It's always like down the line.
Yeah, and it's always like $20 off a digital code. It's never like the physical copy.
Yeah.
Hey, $40 for the $60 game that's been out for... I love Nintendo products, but my God, they don't.
Hey,
they don't ever drop the price.
They keep the value up. And hey, I respect that. They're like, hey, we're not going to take any less, buddies. We got to keep that profit rolling in. You know, hey, But hey,
that's why they have money to float them for 50 fucking years.
That's why they have money to make Game of the Year Clubhouse games. You know, 51 Worldwide Classics. So there you have it. So G2A, I just think this is funny. I wish the companies banded together and said we want a full audit. But then again, they're in like Poland, so there's no jurisdiction or whatever.
Right.
So, but it's just weird.
All right. Moving on.
One of my favorite all-time movies also turned 40. Was May 1980 just the year of greatness? Just three great things happened in May 1980? So Empire Strikes Back.
What was the third one?
May the Empire Strikes Back.
You. Yeah.
turned 40 years old. Remember, zeros and fives. We didn't talk about this in the 35th anniversary.
No, we didn't.
And this podcast probably won't be around in 10 years. If it is, you know, I don't know, one of us might be on it. But anyway, so Empire Strikes Back came out May 17th, 1980. So we're a little bit behind. Oh, that was in the Kennedy Center. May 21st, 1980 here. Also, Mount St. Helens erupted in 1980. That was bad. Some people died with that. It was gigantic. Probably the biggest volcanic eruption we've had since then. Anyway, so comes out, does extremely well critically, and does well at the box office. And obviously, it's the sequel to Star Wars. I love this movie for a bunch of different reasons. When you look at the history of Star Wars, it's almost like the history of video games. Before and after Empire Strikes Back. Star Wars, when that came out, yes, it was a huge cultural phenomenon. Yes, it was a hit. Yes, it merchandising out the wazoo for a movie like that had never happened before. So the first Star Wars was like Pac-Man in that extent, where you can divide the history of movies before and after Star Wars. You can do that with Pac-Man for video games. Empire Strikes Back, though, made the franchise be taken a little more seriously. And it actually established it as a franchise. Because before that, Star Wars was a standalone movie. It was a standalone movie. And it could have died there if that movie came out and no one saw it. It was done. It was a standalone tale in its way. Did it set up a potential sequel? Yes. But it was a self-contained story on its own. And we look at people talking about, well, Lucas planned out that having nightmares. No. Pie in the Sky said it was one movie that was going to be made, and it was financed by for one movie with 20th Century Fox, and that's what that's what it was at the time. And they didn't even think it was going to be that big of a hit at the time. The fucking toys didn't come out in time for Christmas that year. Like there was nothing planned for this until they realized, oh, this is a huge hit. We got to ramp this up. So, Empire Strikes Back, though, is the only one of the original three movies, I would say, that stands alone as this is a serious dramatic film that you can watch and be like, wow, this is super artistic. Wow, there's no, like, just cheap cartoony kid stuff in this movie. Wow, this is something that's kind of terrifying in places. Like, terrifying if you're a kid watching that movie. To me, there's some moments that I wish I was a kid.
Luke in the woods while training is absolutely terrifying.
Oh, when he sees the Darth Vader image?
Yeah.
I wasn't even talking about that, but that's even a sort of a stark, sort of dramatic, artistic scene. It's like, oh, his face shows up in Vader's helmet after he cuts his head off. That shows the demon he's struggling with. I'm more talking about Han getting fucking frozen in carbonite.
Sure.
If you're watching that as a, and that's even before the lightsaber battle. Mm-hmm. If you're watching that as a kid, you just saw this a few years ago when you're 4 years old, a character like get brutalized on screen after he got tortured.
The torture part 5 minutes before was always a bit more scary to me. The carbonite.
That's bad. Come on. Yeah. If you're a kid, I can't even put a frame of reference on that. If you're an 8-year-old kid watcher, people are like, oh, Avengers, Infinity War. You know they were coming back in that movie. I mean, even though you didn't know they was coming, come on.
Yeah.
This is seeing all your heroes get shit on for the last half of that movie. Like, it's peril. It's absolute peril. It's not a happy ending. No. It's a we've barely escaped with our lives ending, yeah. Which is why it's brilliant that they went to that, and no one saw that coming. It didn't get reviewed well by some at the time because of that.
Sure.
They're like, what the hell is this? Because you hadn't seen that before. Like, cliffhanger ending of a movie in a series like that. It just didn't exist. or something like that. Especially when the first movie was so popular, to take that creative risk to go down that road. To be, okay, let's do something. There were some dark moments in the first Star Wars, but it was a light movie in comparison to this.
Sure.
And to go down that route and to see the Rebel Alliance get brutalized at Hoth, barely escape. They're on the run the rest of the movie. They're on the run the whole movie, the Rebel Alliance, and Han and Leia with Chewbacca and C-3PO and R2-D2, who goes with Luke, actually. It's just, they expanded the world and universe. They had a very good director, in Irving Kirshner. Great screenplay. It was rewritten. Lucas didn't like the first draft. It was rewritten. Lawrence Kasdan came on. Leigh Brackett died. I think she did the first draft. She died. Lawrence Kasdan, who still writes today, brilliant, came back and rewrote the final draft. They changed Vader. The most famous thing was they changed Vader into being Luke's father. That was not the plan from the beginning. Don't let anyone tell you any different. Lucas did not have it planned out. Originally, Vader was just some sort of just fucking henchman. That's how he was treated in the first movie. Now he becomes the big baddie, and they sort of gave him humanity. They show him without the helmet. They have the Emperor show up. They gave this universe some sort of life. They expanded upon the original story, which was kind of paper thin. I'm talking about how brilliant the character of Yoda is and the puppetry work by Frank Oz. It's, to me, one of the most brilliant movies I've ever seen. And that's even without it being a Star Wars film, just for what it did as as a sequel.
Sure.
It was sort of like one of those, there's very few of those sequels where you say it's better than the original. Like, this is sort of a handful of all-time films, a true sequel that was better than the original. Like, people say, yeah, Godfather 2 was better than the original. I prefer the original Godfather, but I can see the case for Godfather 2 being a better movie. I do see that.
When it comes to sequels being as good or better than the original, very few movies come to mind. Aliens comes to mind, and that's largely debatable because it's an entirely different story.
Yes,
it's a different style of movie. It's action horror as opposed to suspense. But still, it's a sequel, so I'll let it go. And then Star Wars, and yeah, Godfather 2.
But then you start running out of steam because you say, oh, well, Winter Soldier is better than the first Captain America. But those are different tales entirely. Those aren't using the same character.
I could say that my problem is I can't look at the Marvel movies as individual pieces or separate series. I don't look at Iron Man and then Captain America and then Thor. They're all just,
but they don't continue the story.
Right.
That's what I mean. Like, it's okay. Sure. Iron Man 1 and 2 are not really related. Like,
sure.
It's the same thing with comic books. Like, you read a comic, you throw it out, the next month's a new issue. That's what I mean. Like, it's the same way that Aliens is a different tale with the same one main character.
Right. All I'm really saying, though, is I consider the Marvel movies to all be part of one series, not necessarily a bunch of individual series. Because
yes,
as time and time went on, they all became.
But to me, they're not true sequels.
Sure.
If that makes sense. The Avengers movies are not true sequels to
Fair
each
enough.
Other. So anyway, so again, if I was in the theater, I had never read reports of it, of what people did in the theater after Luke gets his fucking ass handed to him by Vader. Vader fools around with Luke at Bespin for like, yeah, he fools around. You know, Luke gets a couple of little shots in on him. Then Vader says, "Okay, kid, let's go to school." He brutalizes Luke and cuts his hand off. Like, and just ends it as quickly as he can. And then Luke is just like, all right, I'm fucked. And I would have loved to be in the theater and see that, because no one is expecting that to happen. Everyone's expecting Luke to kill Vader.
Sure.
If you're watching that. Then you see the tables turn. You see, you would expect at that point in time, at front of my, you saw Han get put in carbonite. All right, Luke's going to kill Vader and save Han. Right? That's probably what you would think if you're watching that movie up to that point. No. Luke gets his hand cut off, gets his ass kicked. He finds out the guy who just cut his hand off is his dad. And he prefers to commit suicide, basically, and drop off to his death versus, you know. So it's like the worst possible, the low for this main character that you're rooting for. And again, it's just like, it's written so well. It's directed brilliantly. The cinematography of the various shots. One of my favorite shots of the film is the sort of desperate escape with Lando and Chewbacca. And by the way, C-3PO gets blown up into pieces as well. We forgot about that. That must have been harrowing mm-hmm. for kids to see as well. And when they're escaping, that shot of like the sun going down, the sort of angled wide shot with at the docking platform. They're running towards the beautiful shot. It's like one of the most gorgeous shots of any of those three original movies, and they're escaping with barely with their lives there. Yeah, I would have loved to, because now when you see when any movie comes out now, you get like the crowd reactions recorded. I would have loved to have seen the theater just fucking gasp when Vader said, "I am your father." It's a cliche now, obviously.
Sure.
But what if it happened back then and you didn't know?
It would have been crazy.
Would have shit your, 4-year-old Ian's pants. You would have been like, what the hell? Kids were probably shocked walking out of there. The same way we heard like, oh, people were shocked running out of Infinity War. I'm like, really? You were shocked? Okay. You were shocked by that? Okay. That to me was a shocking turn of events. Again, looking back, you didn't know. You didn't know. What about Frank Oz? Come on. Yoda?
Good stuff.
That's a living, breathing little puppet. Way better than any CG bullshit. That's why they came back to the puppet in the new episode, 8 and 9. When Yoda, they go back to the puppet because the CG is lifeless and garbage compared to a good puppet guy. It was a living, breathing creature. I mean, it's fantastic. I can rewatch.
All right, we have to move on to Patreon.
We're not talking about the Hoth battle was fantastic with the walkers and everything. But one last thing, the reason you know this film is the best out of the trilogy, it required the least bullshit tinkering of Lucas for the special editions, and he still tinkered. But there was only like 5 tinkerings being done. Cleaned up the AT-AT walker stop motion. That was fine. You cleaned it up. We get it. You didn't change it. But then like having Vader say get my shuttle for my you don't need that bullshit when he leaves Cloud City. You know he's leaving. And then the one worst thing he did though that they then recorrected when Luke drops off versus joining Vader. They gave him a fucking scream in the special edition. He goes, "Ah!" It's so bad, and it totally counteracts Luke's being calm and realize, all right, I'd rather sacrifice myself than Vader. But then they took it back out again.
Oh, good.
So, like, okay, Lucas realized he went too far there. All right, that's it. Go rewatch Empire Strikes Back. Return of the Jedi, I got to rewatch. I DVR'd it because I know I don't like Return of the Jedi in general, but it's still a decent movie, but I got to give it its fair shake. All right, we have a Patreon, Ian.
We do.
How do you access the Patreon to see a podcast?
Patreon.com/CU podcast.
And what do you get there, Ian?
Oh, writings, full video podcast, a hangout once a month.
All right. We have Patreon poll in third place. Will the value of complete in-box NES games be different now? Have they used plastic cases? 20%. In second place, what were your favorite books or book series growing up or recently? 36%. And in first place, Ian, will we see a boom/revival of physical stores when things return to normal?
I don't think we'll see a boom revival of physical stores quite the way people might think or are hoping, for a couple of reasons. And this is not to say that people aren't going to be happy to go back to their physical stores, their mom and pop shops and things like that, but I don't think you're going to see people rushing out. For a few reasons. One, just because stores are open again doesn't mean that everyone's comfortable with going out. So we're seeing a lot of people who just aren't going out to stores because they're still not comfortable with going out. So that's, lost business right there. Two, people just don't know necessarily that things are open again. We've been doing this for so long that people aren't really aware of what's open. So that kind of goes with the first one and the second one.
That'll depend upon your state, though, right? Some states are...
Sure, but I like I said, what state you're in doesn't affect the fact that people are just uneasy about going out.
Yes, that doesn't change.
And then the other one is
unless you're in some states and going to a lake with having 1,000 people crowd each other.
Lakes of the Ozarks. But the big one is, as a society, we have been moving more and more to online shopping as time has gone on. That's not going to magically revert after 2 months of staying inside. In fact, I think a lot of people have just realized that shopping online is easy. And as places start doing multiple drop-offs, there's all sorts of ways to get something delivered, 2-day delivery, 1-day delivery, contactless delivery, with shit like that. I don't think a lot of people are going to stick with that. We are seeing business come back. I mean, Luna's been open for walk-ins since Thursday. And we are seeing a lot of business come back, but no, I don't think these places are going to get crushed by, you know, throngs of shoppers when they return. People have adjusted.
I think it'll depend on what you're selling, obviously.
Sure.
In general, though, when I go to the UPS store, I don't go out at all. I mean, I didn't do it that much before, so at the gym. I go to the UPS store once a week, and I go to buy food once a week. When I go to the UPS store to drop off certain Blu-rays or things like that, now it's a wall of returns. It was never like that before. It's a wall of boxes because you go to the UPS store, Amazon has a sweet deal. I mean, or UPS does. You don't have to rebox crap you buy on Amazon. You go, here's my dirty shirt I wore once. And they rebox it. They have a service that reboxes it at the UPS store, your crap, and sends it back.
Really? That's crazy.
Yes. It's literally, hey, scan my code, my return code. So it's the easy returns encourages more online shopping. Because before it was a pain. If you bought a shirt, I never buy clothes online because you want to try it on. Now, if I bought through Amazon, I could try on a pair of jeans and be like, oh, this don't fit, and just bring them back. So it's like that extra level of comfort with buying online, which was not there before. And you would say, why couldn't you buy things online before? Yeah, you could, but again, for stuff like clothes, shoes, there are certain things you're not comfortable buying online, and I think you'll never get rid of retail stores for certain things like that. They will always exist. Housewares. Yes. You're not going to buy fucking dishes online, I don't think, ever. Like, because it might be hard to get it there in one piece, but there's certain things you're not going to buy online ever. You're always going to have food stores. There's always been some people who are not be comfortable buying food to get delivered online.
Yes.
That's one thing. And plus the windows, you could never, since everyone needs food, you could never have, I think, a service to deliver to every single food shopper online. That to me would be insane.
You wouldn't be able to.
It would just be too nuts to do that. I think it'll happen slowly where people get used to this again. I think there'll be some parts, and it'll depend upon your region, where some people will feel a connection or some sort of loyalty to their stores to go and back to those individual stores that they like. Because, hey, we know you went through a tough time, your local business. I'm going to go be a patron of your business again. For restaurants and things like that, I don't know to that extent, because restaurants will probably be one of the most dangerous places in terms of spreading these sort
restaurants
of diseases.
Is going to be difficult.
It's going to be a little tougher. I'm not going back to the Chinese buffet anytime soon, and I love the Chinese buffet. That'll be the last place to reopen, will be a buffet. You know what I mean? Like, until we get a combination of vaccines for everyone, and I know we're in human trials already in a couple of different places, but that doesn't mean the vaccine's coming anytime soon. The earliest would be probably end of this year if they fast track, I think. I think it would probably be next year sometime. We need a combination of, obviously, a vaccine, and we line up everyone, we put it in you. And if not, I don't know, we stamp you and say you can't go out, I don't know. Vaccine for everyone, or at least a treatment that it could be like the flu, where you take Tamiflu,
right,
you'll be fine. And I think that'll happen.
Treatment
beforehand.
At least important.
A treatment where, hey, I if you get it, you're not going to die, or else the percentages fall to the flu, where it's like 1 out of 10,000 will die instead of 1 out of 100 will die. Like, we get to that point, I think people will be more inclined to go out and experience things again. I think that's that weird combination of either a vaccine, definitely a vaccine would be great, obviously, unfortunately, the early studies, at least with monkeys, is that you do not get reinfected once you have the antibodies. That's the early good news about this, but it still has to, we have to know that for sure with humans, but that's at least the one silver lining, was is that you get it once, like chicken pox, and you're done.
Right.
Not like the flu where you can get it year after year. Because if that happened with this, holy shit, we go through this every year.
Yeah.
Different vaccines. So you hope it's like that, and it doesn't mutate enough that, like different flu strains where, yeah, you get a flu shot, you can still get it, or maybe more milder symptoms. Either way, you know, we're working faster on a vaccine than in the history of mankind of anything before, obviously. So it'll be that. I think hopefully in 6 months from now, knock on wood, we'll be in a lot better spot, but who knows?
Sure.
So. Sorry.
It's all right.
You want to do that last topic, or you set the
game? I got to go.
You gotta take that lift?
Gotta run.
Okay, we'll leave off this last Q&A until next week. We got through this early podcast. We'll be back to Tuesday next week here. stomachs are rumbling.
Oh, wow, wow.
I still got an hour and a half till I can eat here. Yeah, I hope you're all safe and well out there. I got an NES Punk video in the works. I also have a Flea Market Madness. I have not been editing the past couple weeks there. And the N64 writing team is just about together. I got my own Avengers team.
Assembled.
They're assembled. About it's a dirty dozen. There's a dozen of us right now. We increase the team load, so less reviews from each. So so Christina doesn't have to do like 100 reviews again.
That's good.
Jesus, right? I don't have to do 80. I think 20 is a good number for me. 20? I'm going to start with Wave Race. I like Wave Race. That'll be an easy one to review. It's not too deep. It's a great game. And then I'll work my way around from there. So, anyway. That's Ian Ferguson. Already packing up. I'm Pat Contry. We'll see you in a week. Oh, and watch the YouTube premiere of the intros we do now. If you're listening to this, the audio people, you're listening to this, we do the YouTube premieres. You can come in the chat. You can have fun and see us ramble for a half hour live. Not semi-live. Almost live. All right, bye.